Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
All right, settle down. Get your keisters in your seats and shut your gobs, because this here is issue number 7 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that brings you ringside to all the heavyweights of pulp fiction. I'm your host and referee for this episode, Dancing Dave Robison. Now, one of the things you got to understand about pulp fiction is that it weren't all Seamuses and gumshoes or weird science or all that freaky-deaky horror stuff. Sometimes it was just stories of average Joes taking their shot on the pitcher's mound or in the end zone or in the boxing ring. And that's what we got for you's fine people today. A fine and funny boxing story by a jamoke named Tom Thursday called There's Hicks in Every Trade. It first appeared in All Sports magazine, but apparently no one's been able to figure out exactly when. I'm guessing it's sometime around the early 1940s, and I'll let you good people figure out how I came to that intriguing deduction. Tom Thursday was born in 1894, but don't nobody know when he died, because Thursday ain't his real name, and nobody knows what his real name was. Now, in his youth, he did a lot of work in the circus trade, which explains why flimflams and swindles are a common theme in his stories. While he was a lesser-known pulp writer, he ended up having one of the longest careers in the business. His first story, A Stroke of Genius, appeared in Top Notch magazine on April 1, 1918. As the story goes, he found a copy of the magazine in the subway and decided to write a story for him. The last known publication of his was a true crime piece in 1963, and that's the last anyone heard of him. Thursday was a funny guy, and most of his stories have a humorous spin to them. He wrote a lot of sports stories, some straight-up detective pieces, and several true crime articles. Now, those true crime pieces all take place in Miami, where he settled in the late 1920s. He didn't write enough to support anyone completely, so he was probably writing on the side. And towards the end of his career, he became something of a sourpuss as things started to go south for the pulps. C'est la vie, right? Your narrator for this pleasant little ring romp is Joe Simarco. Now, Joe grew up in Los Angeles, but currently lives in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's an aspiring voice actor focusing on getting into animation and gaming. He's narrated nearly 15 tales for our fellow District of Wonders podcast, Starship Sofa, recorded spot ads for radio stations, and has begun working on professional, commercial, and animation demos. Joe's always been a proud geek, and he's got a soft spot in his heart for fantasy and sci-fi. That's what we like to hear, Joey. Okay, enough gum flapping. It's time to lace up those gloves and listen for the bell. And while you're at it, check your wallet. There's some shady characters skulking around the ring. And you can't be too careful.
There's Hicks in All Trades by Tom Thursday. Now, I don't want to keep anybody in suspense, so I'll break down and confess that this is all about the following mugs, to wit, Viz, and even, i.e., Funny Puss Hicks, Bloodthirsty McGaff, Calathumpian Silo, and yours sincerely, if necessary, Mike McAbner. Funny Puss and me have been managing fighters along the same routes for years, and we got along like Hitler and Churchill. Each time our boys were matched to entertain the customers, I'd be obliged to have the referee examine his brat's gloves to see whether or not they contained plain plaster of Paris, half a horseshoe, or a small iron lid. For the first 5 years, these jovial methods of Funny Puss were highly amusing, but when they got to the stage where he claimed foul each time my boy belted his on the chin, that was a nag from a different racetrack. Well, to reduce a novelette to a short story, I got so sick of Mr. Hicks's coy and cute methods that I almost decided to retire from the fight racket until Funny Puss joined the Nazi army or slipped off the top of the Empire State Building. Same thing, in my opinion. Too much is just overdoing it, and my nerves became as shattered as Warsaw. At the time, I have one built-in beauty entitled Horizontal McHokum, a welter who was doing all right until someone socked him, after which he always mistook the ring floor for a feather bed. I'm about to go nuts, even thinking of going to Moscow with the object of starting up a Republican Party, when I get a very welcome letter from my Uncle Ebenezer Merrifellow up in a slab named Yip Center, New York. Uncle says he's always liked me and would like nothing better than for me to pay him a visit, tumble around in the farm, and make myself at home. I had an idea that there was a catch to it, and it turned out that there was. The name of the catch was Calathumpian Silo, who Uncle stated was the champion of Patch County and was due to flatten Joe the Louie when he grew up. I reach Yip Center a few days later and am amazed to find that Calathumpian Silo is far from a flopola. The kid is about 18, a natural lightweight, and has the courage of a whole family of lions. He works out in the barn where he has rigged up a hick gym with pulleys, a heavy bag, and a light one. Of course, he's not over bright. If he was, what the hell would he want to be a boxer for? He'd be a manager. And I heard what you said. His main punch is a straight right, about the hardest blow in the biz, and the guy who can shoot it over accurately is not en route to the showers.
"I'd like for you to box with me a little, Mr. McAbner," he says.
Personally, I'm supposed to be a great expert on the art of boxing, and even the great sports writers come to me to settle matters of the ring, but no one ever thought I was dumb enough to get into the ring and do a little fisticuffing. My mama never reared no stupid children, although I did wind up as a fight manager when I might have gone to the vegetable business with my cousin Oscar Bibonkalit. "Well, I see no reason why I should not give you the advantage of my great knowledge and ability," I says to Calathumpian. "However," I says, "you will please not bust my beak any harder than absolutely necessary. As to those two sails you note on each side of my head, they are my ears, and they are not to be hit with too much steam. Regarding my stomach, it is a wee bit weak, whilst my kidneys are not in the best of condition." Monsieur Silo gives me a quizzical look and blinks his eyes, not that he could blink anything else.
"Do you mind, Mr. McAbner," he whinnies, "if I hit you on the chin?"
"That reminds me," I says, "I have just had a neat set of teeth, upper and lower berths, placed in my mouth, and too much jarring around might annoy him." He thinks that over one moment, then scratches his head.
"Mr. McAbner," he drawls finally, "maybe you and me better play a game of checkers, huh?"
Just then we hear a loud gong coming from the center of town.
Bong, bong. "Did you hear it? Did you hear it? It's a fire, and I gotta drive the hose cart. See you later, Mr. McAbner."
He dashed outside, mounted a hoss, and rode like hell toward town. It seems that they have a volunteer fire department in Yip Center, and Calathumpian is not only the chief, but the guy who does the driving. The alarm is a large iron hoop gong, and when a fire breaks out, or even in, you belt it with a large hammer. The following day, I begin to teach him the six fundamental blows of the gentle art of getting punch dizzy. There are others, but the main socks are as follows. The left jab is considered the most essential of all, and the mug who knows how to use it is sitting sweet. It is used as defense and offense smack, and it causes considerable anguish to the opposing gent. Just ask the lads who have received some. Comes the left hook, which is used to lead and counter with, and the boy who knows his Hanswurst can even lay his playmate on the floor with it. Then the swing, somewhat like a hook, known as the sleep producer when the sports writers mention it. Then the straight right, a sizzling sock, when the boy who knows how to send it in. Most of the KOs in the ring are delivered by this blow. Next, the uppercut, which should always be used as a counterpunch, and the one most used to score a finisher with. Last, the chop, sent in while the hand is held above the shoulder, usually over the other guy's head. Quite annoying, but it does little damage. As to the much written about and much yapped about 1-2 punch, nuts. This much overrated socking is delivered with a fast left to the head, or bean, followed with a right to the same spot. It is rarely a success in anything more than jarring the other mug and causing him to do a little extra sniffing through the beakola. School's out! Well, on the subject of French-fried Nazis, I spent a few weeks in putting Calathumpian through some snappy paces, and he shapes up very swell. At the end of the 2 weeks, he begins to wonder why he can't get a crack at Joe Louis, or even two Jowl Gelento. I try to get a boy to box him, but it seems that the only two lads in the land who know how to put a glove on their hands instead of their feet have already been knocked canvasward by my hero and do not care to get another treatment via the same source. And this state of affairs is very sad, like Hitler with a pan full of kosher, and I'm about to send out a hurry call for some fight fodder when manna drops from a freight train. This is in the form of a bindle stiff or the like, and I meet him whilst he's canvassing the town's best grease garage, Oxford for beanery, in search of some steaming coffee, or perhaps a snack of sauerbraten, whatever that is. I soon note, with unsurpassed pleasure, that one of his ears is a member of the Cauliflower Avenue, which means he never got it playing the dog races. A boxer, eh? I says. Yeah, he comes back. I got it in a jam back east with the burglar what managed me, and I had to lam out. Anything serious? Nothing much. Only I got bored watching him chisel 90% of my purses, and I just socked him over the conch with a water bucket. I think the lug has croaked, so I got scared and beat it out of town. Later, I learned that the louse is okay. In the meanwhile, I'm a bum. Got a name? They call me Kid Okie Dokie, and I had about 50 professional fights. I won most of them with a punch. Except them that you lost, I adds. What's your real name, seeing that it's none of my business?
Ferdinand P. Mallory.
What's the P stand for?
Percival.
I'll take Kid Okie Dokie. I pay the feed bill for her Okie Dokie and arrange to have him box Calathumpian Silo 1 week from tonight. Of course, I have to stake him to some grits and gravy dough and see that he does a little training, but what do I care for $3? The county is aroused over their pet palooka being matched with an outsider, and the night of the two-man Warsaw, the little arena is packed. It was your typical Rube audience, with farmers to the right of you, farmers to the left of you, onward the hay and the vegetables. Now listen, I say to Calathumpian. You just walk right out there and paste this merry monkey on the kisser, see?
Where at is this kisser?
He wants to know. The kisser, my friend, is Yale for mug. Get it?
Sure,
he says.
You want that I should punch him right in the belly, huh?
That, I retorts, is quite near enough. The bell. Her Okie Dokie rushes from his corner with the sincere intention of knocking Calathumpian into the nearest hayloft with a left hook to the jaw. It just miffed my brat by a mere split hair, due to the fact that Okie Dokie's timing was not on time. It had more steam behind it than a boiler room, and was just as well that it missed the mark. Had it landed, Calathumpian would have landed with it and against it. Calathumpian gets in close and shoots in a right uppercut. Okie Dokie snarls and remarks that my boy is a very large bum, and where did he learn to box? This crack makes Calathumpian get a bit red in the puss, and he pushes Okie Dokie away so hard that he nearly upsets him on his sit spot. The chased customers, sensing a grudge fight, whoop it up for Silo. Okie Dokie dances to the center of the ring and tries to knock down Calathumpian's left guard. This is a major error on Okie Dokie's part. Silo lets go his straight right, and it lands plumb on the chinola of her Dokie. He falls over frontwards, flat on his beak, which is a pretty sure sign that a boxer has lost interest in the business at hand. He's out for as far as Long Island, if you know what I mean. If you don't, write a letter to the papers. The hometowners are now sure that they have the next lightweight champ of the earth and give the boy a very large hand. As for Calathumpian, he is puffed up like a go-ring, which same as plenty of air.
When do I get to fight next, Mr. McAbner?
He wants to know.
See if you can make it tomorrow night, huh?
Keep your pajamas on, I says. Rome wasn't built in a day.
Why?
He wants to know. Labor trouble, I guess. Meantime, you ain't no Benny Leonard or Joe Gans.
Why not?
I'll send you 4 or 5 books on the matter when I get back to New York. It would take me 6 months to tell you why not. Just let it go and take it easy. I'm puzzling what passes from my mind to dig up another playmate for Calathumpian when I read in the papers where my old pal and annoyer, Funny Puss Hicks, is in Buffalo. He's exhibiting a new lightweight of his with the tasty and terrible title of Bloodthirsty McGaff. He's boxing one soccer swan dive in that burg, and I hit upon the notion that it would be like Funny Puss to come forth to Yip Center with his new prize and do some mayhem with Calathumpian Silo. The next day, Funny Puss receives one of my most cajoling and persuasive diplomatic notes. Chamberlain should have seen it. And I tell Hicks that I've missed him, and that all is forgiven. I go on to state that there is no reason why two old-timers should be on the outs when they could be on the ins, especially when there's some dough to be had. I then give a Hawkeye's view of Calathumpian Silo, showing all his good points and rot like that, and wind up by suggesting that we could both haul down some sweet sugar if we would up the stakes and hide a Yip Center. Funny Puss replies that he's very delighted indeed to hear from an old palsy walsy, and he says how much he has missed me, the liar. What is more, he'd be proud and happy to come up to Yip Center and partake of the home life down on the farm, etc. and etc. He winds up his letter by inquiring whether he's supposed to have his brat box for a bouquet of fertilizer or a can of Soviet spinach. In other words, Funny Puss wants to know whether or not he gets paid or just comes for the ride in the fresh country air. I promptly reply that he can have all of 25% of the gross, whilst I should be satisfied with a mere 35%, seeing that I'm not only the manager but the matchmaker as well. He does not appear to take kindly to my mathematics and wants to know if I'm managing Adolf Hitler or Joe Stalin, seeing that my idea of percentage leaves him on the outskirts of the almshouse. He also remarks in a P.S. that they do not care to walk from Buffalo to Yip Center, especially with carpet slippers, and will I be good enough to send on the fare. Since there'll be no fight unless I send him the dough, I put the bite on Uncle Ebenezer for the chips and hurl it towards Herr Hicks. He arrives 3 days later, full of corn and weird ideas, or what have you behind the bar. I proudly display Calathumpian to Funny Puss in the gym, and he says I have a positive world champ if I keep him out of the ring, and I don't allow him to see too many movies. You are still half-witted, I says. Have you ever seen a better prospect? Prospect for what? He demands. Plumbing? Steam fitting? Or just plain farming? If you would care to back up your loose lingo with some cash, either hot or cold, I'll be happy to wager the Calathumpian Silo belts Bloodthirsty McGaff out of the ring within 3 rounds. If the fight's with regulation 3-ounce gloves, says Funny Puss, I'll be glad to accept your bet, Mr. McAbner. Of course, if you're going to send your mug into the ring with a war tank in one hand and a machine gun in the other, anything is liable to happen. I will be glad to bet my end of the purse against yours, I says. I'll be glad enough to take your dough, says Funny Face. Who will hold the money? I will hold the money, I says. If it's all the same to you, he comes back, I would be happy to have my money held by either Captain Kidd or John Dillinger. Would the mayor of Yip Center be okay? I ask. He's also the president of Corn County National Bank and an elk. Oh, an elk, eh? Says Funny Puss. That's okay by me. I'm also an elk. So that was all settled. Just then the fire bell goes boom, boom. And pretty soon the hose cart comes dashing down the street with Calathumpian Silo driving like mad. What is this? Demands Funny Puss. A scene from the gay 90s? That, I says, is the Yip Center Volunteer Fire Department in action. Speed, eh? Is that your boy driving? That's him, the next lightweight champion of the world. The next world? Not this one, says Funny Puss. Well, Yip Center is all head up over the forthcoming Silo McGraff two-man world war, and I have a great load of refined and granulated goo about the mess in the Corn County Clarion, a weekly with the accent on the week. I give Silo 40 chances to McGraff's 1 to win the fight, and when Funny Puss sees the write-up, he calls on the editor and wants to sue him for libel. Meanwhile, he struts around town and drops casual remarks hither and likewise yon that it is a crime the way a nice little boy like Calathumpian Silo is going to get his face pasted proper by a real boxer like Bloodthirsty McGaff. This bragging gets the yokel locals all sore up, since they are sure that Calathumpian could lick both Mussolini and Hitler with nothing more potent than a bow and arrow, They want to know if Funny Puss has any money that he would like to lose on the brawl, and Herr Hicks says he's very sorry indeed that he does not control the gold supply, so he could bet it all on McGaff. He covers about 300 bucks of the natives' dough, and all the time I thought the big bum was broke. Coming to the Silo McGaff Vandango, I'm delighted that none of the big sports writers was at the ringside. It is too bad, though, that none of the Hollywood talent scouts were there, especially those looking for half-wit and humor. No fooling, what actually happened would have made tramps out of Charlie Chaplin and the Ritz brothers. Shortly before the fight, Funny Puss comes into our undressing room and wants to know if I'd like to cancel the bets, seeing that he's hooked the natives for all the dough that he will need for some time. I never trim a pal, he says. I never like to steal babies from candy. Never mind me, I says. When this fight is over, you will go home in a barrel. Huh, I hope the barrel is full of beer, he says. Well, suit yourself, sucker. Remember, I gave you a chance to pull out of a bum's bet. The only bum around here is Bloodthirsty McGaff. See you at the ringside. I gave Calathumpian some specific instructions before he entered the ring, account of I did not want him to be killed whilst so young. Personally, I didn't know whether McGaff was good, no good, or just lousy, because I'd only seen him perform in the gym. And don't let any mug tell you that they can get to the lowdown on a boxer from his gym work. That's the apple fritters, smothered in bologna.
Do not worry about me, Mr. McGaffner, says Calathumpian. I will whip this McGaff fellow with no trouble at all. All I want to do is hit him one good one in the belly. I don't like him nohow. I met him on the street the other day, and he says something I do not like. No, sir, I do not like what he says at all.
Well, what did he say?
He says that if I do not go to the hospital, I will go to the undertaker. I do not like such talk, Mr. McAbner, and I will hit him much harder because this is no way to talk to me.
You're quite right, I says. He is no gent, and his manager is also no gent. Go right out and smack him over. Don't forget that straight right. Don't forget, you can lead a hoss to water, but a punch must be driven. The referee calls the lads to the center of the ring and gives his idea of the latest in instructions. He tells them to hit in the clinches if they feel like it, but that no fouls will be allowed. He also says that the rounds will be 4 minutes instead of three, because it makes the fight longer. He begins to tell them about how long the Sullivan-Kilrain fight was when I give the signal to the timekeeper to bank the bell. Calathumpian jumps from his corner like he was on springs and meets McGaff before he could get to the center of the ring. My boy starts with the notion that he'll slay him with his famed straight right, but McGaff has other ideas. As Silo swung, McGaff slipped to the left and my boy muffed a ring post by a mere razor edge. Had that sock landed, the fight would have been on ice. So would Monsieur McGaff. While my brat is wondering how McGaff got away, Funny Puss's lad makes a right flank movement, comes up behind Silo, and clips him on the back of the neck. Calathumpian turned to me for advice, the wee bit upset. Sock him right in the kisser, I says.
Sure,
says Silo.
Right in the belly.
McGaff faints with his left. No dice. McGaff slips in a sweet left hook to the chinola. This irks Calathumpian, and he decides to get in a punch himself, seeing that there are two men in the ring and both have the same privilege. He rushed at McGaff and, after taking a light 1-2 on the mush, he lets go his straight right. He put everything but the U.S. Marines in that punch, and when he connected, McGaff flopped over backwards on his rear housing. His eyes are somewhat glazed, and he has the most peculiar of expression on his front page. I yelped to Calathumpian to get into a neutral corner so the referee could count up to 156 if need be, but he turns to me and wants to know what the hell a neutral corner may be. I point to the farthest corner away from the resting McGaff, otherwise he might have gone to Berlin or perhaps Moscow. The referee, without waiting to see whether Calathumpian was in a neutral corner or in the Bronx, began to count over McGaff that was enough to make an adding machine think it was a snail. Of course, I do not complain at the fast counting, although Funny Puss Hicks is not entirely satisfied with the speedy mathematics.
I'm being framed,
whinnied Funny Puss. You are far from an oil painting, I says. Quiet, please. The hometowners yell down any more remarks that came from Herr Hicks, and he begins to make faces at one and all. He also showed some new finger movements that neither Stokowski nor Panderewski need on the piano. the movements of Funny Puss being between the thumb and the nose. When the referee reached 8 in about 4 seconds, McGaff moved his eyes, shook his head, and then seemed amazed to find himself on the floor. Knowing that fights are rarely won from that position, he made arrangements to leap from that location with much speed and alacrity. He grabs Calathumpian around the shoulders and holds on like Tanglefoot to a fly. My brat looks towards me for advice, and I motion him to break away. "Kick him in the shins!" hollers some polite towner from the 2-bit seats. Silo thinks this advice is very sound, and promptly lands on McGaff's dogs with both large feet. With a yell, McGaff broke and began to merry-go-round, his face twisted from hurt toes. Funny Puss claims everything from foul to Danzig, much to the amusement of the customers. The bell saves McGaff, and he hobbled back to his corner. I catch the eye of Funny Puss and wave to him in my most jovial manner. He again uses the famed finger movement, thumb to beak and fingers waving like Kansas wheat in the breeze. "You're a cinch to win," I says to Calathumpian.
"Yup,"
he says.
"But why don't that fellow let me hit him?"
"Just bashful, I guess. But you just go right out there and sock him down. He needs a rest anyway." The second round was quite fast indeed. They looked like a pair of club fighters, meaning sucker fighters, who please the crowd and wind up on their heels. They also use pivot punches, rabbit punches, and everything but biting the clinches. That must have been an oversight on their part. I call the attention to the dizzy referee to the illegal socks, and he tells me to mind my own business, if any. During the 4th minute of the round, Silo backs McGaff into his own corner and nails him with his straight right. Bam! Right in the kisser. Harvard for face. Again, McGaff decides to meet the canvas halfway and flops to the floor. Funny Puss yelps his tonsils out, claiming foul, murder, and assorted kidnapping. Calathumpian, in his excitement, goes to 3 different corners before he decides on which one is perfectly neutral. He finally picks out the one next to Funny Puss and tries to crown him with the water bucket. I wave Silo over to my side and watch McGaff play Rip Van Winkle on the canvas. McGaff stirs at the count of 7, wiggles his left leg, twitches an eyebrow, then blinks at the dome lights. Making up his mind that he was in a fight, not a tea party, he struggles to the fray and goes into the very clinchy clinch. The way he held on to Silo, you would think McGaff was in love with him. The mob howls for the referee to break them, even if it is necessary to hit McGaff over the dome with the ring post. The referee had his own rules about boxing, whatever they were, having taken a correspondence course in blacksmithing. The bell saved McGaff, and Funny Puss jumped into the ring and took his pet to the stool. The lad didn't know whether he was in the ring or in Albania. The 3rd round will be the last. Don't walk out yet. They come out fighting, as the sports writers innocently remark, and Silo clips McGaff with a right uppercut to the chin. McGaff staggers and indicates that he is not fond of any uppercuts to the chin, or even elsewhere. He shoves 2 weak rights into Silo's pan, and then backs away like Calathumpian had the mange or maybe smallpox. Silo comes back with the right cross to the head, and McGaff don't care for that either, proving that he is hard to please. Just then, I look toward the corner of Funny Face, with the noble object giving him a pleasant smile, and note that he is nowhere to be seen. But at that moment, the boys do some solid and swift mixing, and I think no more of the strange disappearance of Herr Hicks. Soon, McGaff is horizontal on the canvas, from another straight right, and it seems that he will remain there until the referee counts at least 1,000. And then, a very annoying thing happened.
Bong! Bong! Bong!
It was the fire bell. Half of the customers, members of the volunteer fire department, left their seats and began to climb over each other's heads toward the exits. What a scramble! I am in the direct line of fire, and do I get trampled. To make matters worse, as the guy remarked who found ketchup in his oatmeal, a heavy body seemed to jump on me and knock me to the floor. I disentangle myself from the load of arms and legs to see what hit me. It was no less than Calathumpian Silo, and he was all excited.
"Hurry, Mr. McAbner," he shouts. "Get me out of here, quick. I gotta drive the hose cart. I gotta drive the hose cart."
"Get back in that ring," I commands. "If you leave, you will be disqualified and lose the fight, which same you have won."
"Sorry," he says. Can't help it. I tell you, I gotta drive the hose cart.
I look toward the ring and see the referee counting over the manly form of bloodthirsty McGaff. When the count reaches 9, McGaff gets to his pins and staggers around like he had just finished a gallon of Florida corn. He sees the referee dimly and makes a feeble pass at his nose with his right paw. The referee ducks and grins. Next, the referee notes that Calathumpian Silo has left the ring. Reaching for McGaff's right hand, he raises it high in the air.
The winner! He bleats. Silo is hereby and herewith disqualified for leaving the ring while the fight is going on. Don't we have fun? I see Funny Puss Hicks the following morning. He's quite proud and happy, having collected all the bets and did the big bum cash in. Nice morning, he says. What is nice about it? I demands. I never noticed it was raining, he goes on. I never noticed that you banged that fire gong last night either, I snaps. But I know it now.
What's wrong with it?
He says.
Did you expect me to play a tune on it?
I never knew Captain Kidd had a brother.
Did you mean to tell me that there wasn't any fire last night?
He asks.
Fire? Hell! It was just another false alarm, like bloodthirsty McGaff.
Nice to meet you, Mr. McAbner,
he says and struts nonchalantly down the street.
Nuts to you, Mr. Hicks.
Well, to come to the end of the perfect fray, I don't see Funny Puss again until 3 months later. I'm strolling around the New York's World Fair when who should I lamp out but Hicks, looking a bit seedy and down on his luck. He greets me with a brotherly affection, the big stiff, and wants to know how I'm getting on in the world.
Now I know you've forgotten about that little trick I pulled up in Yip Center, he says. It was all in fun.
No hard feelings, I says.
I always say you were a real swell guy.
Thanks, I says. The fact of the matter is, I have forgotten all about it.
You are a great guy.
Have dinner yet? I asks.
Nah, he says. To tell the truth, I ain't been doing so well lately. Tough luck. Just got on about $7 to my name.
I take him to the French casino and tell him to order from soup to nuts. The bill comes to $6.50, and when we reach the dessert, I ask him to pardon me a moment as I have to make an important telephone call. I'll be right back, I says, and bring some cigars. 2 minutes later, I'm on the phone and ask for the French casino. Please tell that funny-looking guy sitting alone at the left side to come to the phone, I says to the lad who answers. A few seconds later, Funny Puss is on the wire. Kid, I says, I'm very sorry indeed to tell you that I can't get back. I hear a gargle or the like. Funny Puss has lost his breath.
Hey, listen, he yelps. You can't do this to me. All I got is $7 and the bill is $6.50.
That makes out about right, I purrs. Just leave the extra 50 cents for the waiter.
What do you mean?
He wants to know. I forgot to tell you, I says, that I'm a member of the fire department, and someone just turned in a 3-alarm fire. I gotta drive the hose cart.
There's Hicks in all trades.
You just heard There's Hicks in Every Trade by Tom Thursday, narrated by Joe Simarco. I love this story. If I didn't know it was written in the 40s, I'd swear it was a delightful homage to the language and culture of the era. But this is authentic, the real deal, every line packed with as much sardonic wit and vernacular as the words can hold. Did it take you a while to get into the groove of the language? Yeah, me too. But once I did, what a delightful ride. You know, there's another writer whose language requires your brain to kind of recalibrate before you pick up the rhythm. Shakespeare. Now, I'm sure being compared to Shakespeare has old Tom Thursday grinning up in heaven. Now, this story ain't no Hamlet, but it does have that same quality of traveling through time and listening to someone from another era chatter away in your ear. It's stories like this that make me thank all the literary gods for Herr Gutenberg and his printing press. Through the catalyzing fusion of language, ink, and paper, we're able to freeze time, like a fly in amber. Now we can read the words of people who lived in a completely different world and project ourselves into their lives. Now, when I read contemporary authors writing stories set in another era, it's not quite the same. It's like walking through a museum where the set pieces are all staged to reenact some different place and time. But reading this story, I feel like Doctor Who, and the pages in my hand are my own personal TARDIS. Log that as nerd reference number 516, please. And then I start thinking about the digital age and all the amazing stuff we're creating that's comprised of nothing but electronic bits and bytes and pixels. And it scares me a little bit to think that there are astonishing literary works of great beauty and importance that will vanish from existence because of a corrupted hard drive. That without electricity and computers, they'll be lost. But that's just silly, right? I mean, there's always going to be computers, and there will always be electricity. Won't there? Now, for this week's showcase, I wanted to share with you a blog that is a remarkable hub of pulp news and content. The blog is called All Pulp, with the tagline, your source for the who, what, when, where, and how of the modern pulp revival. And friends, they live up to that claim. They've got interviews with pulp artists and writers, press releases about the latest developments in the world of pulp fiction, reviews of novels, audio fiction, cinema, and graphic novels. They've got commentary. It's all there. And this isn't one of those once-a-week posting endeavors. All Pulp is all the time. Nearly every day, these folks are making sure the world is up to speed on all things pulpish in every media available. It's staffed by a veritable rogues gallery of pulp authors and aficionados, including Sarge Portera, Tommy Hancock, Van Allen Plexico, Ron Fortier, Derek Ferguson, Bobby Nash, and Barry Reese. If you want to keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world of pulp fiction, I'd highly recommend adding them to your list. You can find all this fabulous pulpy goodness at allpulp.blogspot.com. And you know who else has their finger on the pulse of all things pulp? The heavyweight champion team of Protecting Project Pulp, that's who. Our assistant editor, Fred Hammerfist Heimbau, is a one-man juggernaut in the pulp ring, with a vicious 1-2 combination of a sharp eye for great pulp stories and the best nose for sniffing out where to find them. Our sound engineer, Tom the Titan O'Dwyer, has the most amazing footwork around, dancing around the audio ring, always delivering a powerful uppercut that lays us out every week. No cauliflower ears on this guy, let me tell you. And then there's our editor, producer, and hard-nosed trainer, Tony Smith, always making sure we stick and move, bob and weave, and keep delivering a pulp fiction haymaker every week. We hope you enjoyed the story this week. And remember, you can always have ringside seats to the best pulp fiction by subscribing to Protecting Project Pulp on iTunes or at our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com. And you can always leave a comment or two for us on the episode post or in the PPP forums. Now, next week, we're off to save America from the nefarious schemes and weird science of a Russian madman in Where Caverns Yawned by Captain S.P. Meek. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Robison, and I'll leave you with this thought. The technology of Aristotle or even Shakespeare was parchment, quill, and ink. That technology that has allowed us to be enriched by the insights and imagination of ancient storytellers has all but vanished. We've been fortunate that the output of that technology, pages with words on them, can endure long after the technology itself is obsolete. Do you wonder, like I do, if our legacy of digital pixels and bits and bytes will endure so long? I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.